This is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Shortages of life-saving medicines and drugs are becoming increasingly common in the U.S. Since 2007, the number of drugs considered in short supply has tripled. That's according to a report released earlier this year from the federal government. Many of the drugs in short supply are generic, sterile, injectable drugs. Some are to control pain, others fight infections, treat heart problems, enable nutrition, or battle cancer. When there's a shortage, how do doctors decide who gets medication or treatment and who doesn't? Dr. Yoram Ungeru joined me to walk through this topic. He's a faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Ethics and a pediatric hematologist-oncologist at the Herman and Walter Samuelson Children's Hospital at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore. Dr. Ungeru is part of a working group which published in the journal Pediatrics a sort of blueprint for how to prevent chemotherapy drug shortages. When we spoke in February, I asked how often he's been faced with a drug shortage.
We have shortages frequently. Oftentimes, we're able to figure ways to get around those shortages. The shortages may require that we give our patients the medications at times when they're not necessarily due so that we can avoid an actual shortage.
You get ahead of the treatment schedule to avoid a shortage, or you delay it?
Both. For example, a common drug that was short a couple of years ago was a drug called methotrexate. And we use that drug for different types of kids with cancer. And we knew that drug was short, and we would have to bring kids in to batch them. So we would bring kids ahead of their schedule or after their schedule to give them the drug because we had an announcement from the FDA or the drug manufacturers that there was going to be a shortage. So we tried to use it as fast as we could. The problem then became that what do you do when there's an actual shortage of that drug? And that, for the most part, we've been able to avoid with that specific drug. But we've had other drugs that have been in short supply as well. And that's the tragic, difficult choice that you have to make.
But overall, how would you describe the consequences of drug shortages?
These shortages have a huge impact. And I hesitated because we're not sure to what extent the shortages are going to impact the lives of kids. I can tell you that there have been children who have been impacted immediately. But for example, when we've had to give medications not at the scheduled time, we don't know what the impact of that shortage is going to be. We in childhood cancer practice what we call evidence-based medicine. We're very data-driven. In other words, we give medicines based on clinical trials and years of evidence. And suddenly, we are now forced to give drugs in a schedule that isn't known or to give an alternative drug that we don't know necessarily what its influence is going to be on that child's disease. And so we're not sure what's going to happen. And we honestly are keeping our fingers crossed. But imagine having to tell a child or the child's parents, we're not sure how this is going to impact you because we have a shortage of this drug, which should be available and isn't.
I think many of us think of shortages of drugs as something that happens in developing countries. Why are there drug shortages in the U.S.?
That's a great question. And while there are shortages in some other countries, this is primarily a problem here in the United States.
More than in other countries?
Much more than in other countries. In fact, I've queried colleagues of mine abroad, do you guys have shortages? And they think I'm joking. Why would we have shortages?
Why would we have shortages? My question.
Okay, it's a great question. So there's a lot of reasons why we have shortages. There are economic drivers behind this, manufacturing and quality issues. For example, you may be familiar, a year or two ago, there was the New England Compounding Company that produced an injectable form of a steroid that was tainted, and there was a lot of news reports of people getting fungal meningitis and things of that nature. So quality is a big problem. There's some regulatory considerations. Economics, though, I'll come back to that, is a big, big issue. A lot of these drugs, as I mentioned, have been around for decades. They're very cheap. The pharmaceutical companies don't get a lot of profit when they sell these. And maintaining a production line for some of these drugs is very costly. And they may decide that it's not worth their while to continue to produce this drug because they don't get a lot of profit.
I'm sorry. Let me make sure I understand that. You said the drug is very cheap. And you also said maintaining the production line is costly. And I presume a drug company prices to cover its costs.
They do. And you picked up on an important point here. A number of years ago, the federal government decided that it was going to reimburse differently on how a lot of these sterile injectables are made, and this is specifically Medicare reimbursement. In the past, drug companies were able, and physicians were able, to charge pretty much whatever they wanted for a lot of these drugs, and it resulted in skyrocketing prices. And in an effort to curb these skyrocketing prices, the federal government stepped in and set a ceiling on the amount of money they were going to reimburse for a lot of these drugs. And that amount of money is quite small. So the profit margin is quite small for some of these old, tried and true life-saving drugs. And at the end of the day, some of these manufacturing and pharmaceutical companies, they're a business. They have a bottom line to attend to. And so they may say, it's not worth our while to maintain this very costly production line. We have to meet standards that the FDA sets. We have a lot of money and infrastructure that goes into it. And when we're only being reimbursed a small amount, they may decide that they're going to essentially pull the plug. And what's important to appreciate is that there's consolidation within the marketplace. What I mean by that is there are very few companies that actually make these sterile injectable chemotherapeutics. In 2008, three companies alone, that's it, made 71% of all the sterile injectable cancer drugs. And they all had problems in their production line. And this is why in 2008, for example, there were a lot of shortages. And this continued up until 2012. So there's a lot of considerations that go into why these shortages exist.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Kast, speaking with Dr. Yoram Ungaru. He's a faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a pediatric hematologist-oncologist at the Herman and Walter Samuelson Children's Hospital at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore. We're talking about drug shortages. In your article in Pediatrics, you and your colleagues recommended six actions to address drug shortages. Your first recommendation is aimed at the Food and Drug Administration. And FDA officials wrote a response saying, hey, we're doing that. We're doing what they suggested already. So in simplest terms, tell me what it is you think the FDA should be doing more of or how it could make this situation better.
So I have sympathy for the FDA. They traditionally were tasked with the relatively easy, in quotation marks, job of making sure that the drugs that are used in the United States are safe and effective. And now they find themselves having to monitor drug shortages. And this isn't something that originally was in their purview. And they're trying to do this. The FDA is woefully understaffed, and they'll tell you this when it comes to this regard. There is a drug shortage program within the FDA, and it's staffed by 11 full-time employees. And they are forced to monitor and deal with these shortages. Now, what's interesting is the FDA doesn't monitor all shortages of drugs in the United States. Depending on which source you look at, there's about 300 drugs right now in the United States that are in short supply. If you look at the FDA's website and see how many drugs are in short supply, you'll see far fewer. And the reason for that is the FDA limits itself to monitoring shortages of only what's called medically necessary drugs, that is, drugs that are used for a serious medical condition for which there's no alternative. And the FDA is the first to admit the reason that they limit themselves to monitoring only this group of drugs is because they simply don't have the man or woman power to monitor all the drug shortages. And along those lines, while our emphasis is on the chemotherapy drugs that are used in childhood cancer, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that that's one small percentage of the drugs that are short. There's about 35 chemotherapeutics that have been short, but there, I told you there's 300 drugs that are in short supply. So these shortages affect every single person out there. You don't have to have cancer to be impacted by these shortages.
Right, and you make the point in your article that that while you're writing specifically about pediatric chemotherapy drugs, that you think that your recommendations would apply to a broader range of drugs. And you also point out in your article, which I didn't know, that about two-thirds of kids with cancer in the U.S. are part of a clinical trial of some kind of measurement of how this treatment, how effective it is. And that's why I want to ask you about what you flag as what you think will be the most controversial recommendation, which is that if a drug is in short supply, a patient in a clinical trial should not have any more claim to it than a patient not in a clinical trial. Why did you recommend that?
So this was, I think, the area that sparked the most debate within our working group. Our working group consisted of pediatric oncologists, bioethicists, folks with expertise in public policy, pharmacists, legal scholars, and we even had FDA representation there. And this was an area that really was, I won't say contentious, but got a little heated. So research, as you may know, is risky. In other words, we assume that whatever intervention, in this case it's usually some form of treatment, is going to be better than the current standard of care. In other words, the current best approach. But we're not sure. That's why we're doing it under the guise of a research study. And the majority of kids, as you stated, do participate in a research trial at some point in the care of their cancer. And they're taking a risk. Mm-hmm. The intervention, the research part of their treatment may be better, it may not. And therefore, I think an argument could be made that these children are owed something because they're essentially taking one for the team.
So far, you've been arguing against your recommendation.
I'm getting there. Yes, I have. You've been listening. The reason, however, that we recommended that kids who are participating in research not get preferential access to getting a scarce drug is the following. We don't want kids and parents of kids with cancer to feel that they have to enroll in a research study in order to get access to a scarce drug. People should enroll in research because it's consistent with their values and preferences, and they believe that the research study is something that is good for them. They shouldn't fear that the only way they're going to get a drug is if they enroll in the study, if that study, though, is not good for them. So that's one reason. We don't want people to participate in research for the wrong reason. The other concern is the idea that we really think that when you're talking about a scarce drug, we should limit that drug's use to instances where there's clear evidence that it's proven to do something beneficial. And a research study hasn't proven that yet. That's the reason we do research. We're trying to prove that the drug or the intervention is to the benefit of the individual. And we haven't gotten there yet. And then the last reason, probably the least important of the three, but it is there's this fear this concern of how things will be perceived in the greater world if we're saying these kids who are participating in research are going to get preferential access. That could potentially be spun in a bad way.
Thank you. Thanks for explaining it to us.
Thank you.
Dr. Yoram Ungeru is a faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a pediatric hematologist-oncologist at the Herman and Walter Samuelson Children's Hospital at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore. He was part of a working group which published in the journal Pediatrics a sort of blueprint for how to prevent chemotherapy drug shortages. We spoke in February. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. More ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.